Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
I find the process of donating, it's a part of what's called like your speech, but the reality is, why should our speech be worth more than other people's speech? I think that's the fundamental problem with the system. And I don't like the laws that we have. And you know, if we don't exercise our speech, we end up not having a seat at this table at all.
Hey everyone, we have an awesome episode today. We are speaking with Matt and Swati, the founders of Insight, which is a combination of a venture capital firm, a political activism organization, and a philanthropic venture. The two of them are power players in Silicon Valley. Swati is a former venture capitalist and employee at Square. Importantly for this conversation, she also went to Harvard and Oxford with Pete Buttigieg and played a leading role in financing his campaign. No matter what happens going into the Joe Biden administration, she is sure to play a major role in forming and shaping the future of the party. Same time too, Matt is incredibly impressive as well. He was on the founding team at Apple that came up with the iPhone, and he went on to co-found Nest, which later sold to Google. The two of them are at the nexus of every single trend this podcast has sought to focus on, from tech to power to campaign finance to the future of the Democratic Party during this moment of realignment. So the two of them are the perfect guests to speak to. The part I enjoy the most about this episode is how frank and open they are. It's easy to imagine people who've been as successful as they are at a young age to be reserved and separate from everything, but the two of them engage even when we push them a little.
This was a really interesting opportunity for me. I think one of the biggest problems for a lot of people who are in my space, which is kind of a critique of the power system, is that you very rarely actually get to engage and talk to the people in the power structures themselves. I really appreciated Swati and Matt, you know, frankly, taking some of my harsh and hard questions around Pete Buttigieg, around the way campaign finance works, around how their values shape the type of people that they fund, and whether they're placing too much of an emphasis on social liberalism rather than on focusing on the economic problems that we have here as a society. So overall, it was an incredibly good-spirited, good faith discussion, maybe amongst people who disagree, and that's all good, but it's an opportunity for all of you to actually get to hear from somebody who is actively involved in the Buttigieg campaign in terms of funding Democratic candidates, in terms of funding the type of activism which you may not necessarily agree with. And I think that you will be much better off in terms of understanding that superstructure after this episode. And before we get into this episode, I just want to say I've been really heartened by all of the signups for our Substack newsletter. I just love seeing those numbers go up and up and up. Now, we are nearly at 1,000 signups. And I wanted to say that we'll have a special treat for all of you whenever we hit 1,500. So why don't you go ahead and hit the subscribe button, therealignment.substack.com.
And my favorite part of every Substack is our bookshop.org link. Bookshop is an awesome website where you can support local booksellers and referrers like us. If you purchase a book on the site from our Realignment book list, we get 10%, but most importantly, you support a local bookseller. Follow the link at the bottom of the show notes or check it out at the Substack newsletter. We've had a bunch of you all purchase books, and we'd love to hear more from you about books we should be reading, what we should check out, and what you're personally enjoying. We'll definitely add them all to the list.
That's right. I love sharing all those recommendations. It is time for our favorite segment of the week, which is taking your questions, realignment cues. Just as a special reminder, if you leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, a written review, you can ask us a question there, or you can take a screenshot of your review, send it into realignmentpod@gmail.com. I know I irked some of you by once again begging on my hands and knees for 5-star reviews, but guess what, guys? We got 100 more. And you know what? That puts a little bit of a jig in my step. And so I want to see 100 more and 100 more after that and 100 more. And if I check and I only see like 25, I'm going to be sad. I'm going to be totally honest with you. So with all of that, Marshall, what is our question for the week?
This week's question comes from G. Meyer on Apple Podcasts. Enjoy the show. Love the interviews with Galloway and Weinstein. We need more respectful discourse on agreements and disagreements. Keep battling partisanship and your audience will continue to grow. So the question is, What is your favorite movie during the lockdown and why? And Sagar, I love this question because it's starting very seriously with the point about partisanship and battles, agreement and disagreement, but it's pivoting to something casual like that. We definitely appreciate that, especially considering the insanity and real honest trepidation that people in DC are feeling this week.
Yeah, thank you very much for that question. That's right. Marshall and I are both literally locked inside of our homes because our city is a literal occupied fortress at the moment. So it's fun to reflect on what exactly we've enjoyed. I'm going to go ahead with an unconventional answer. I'm not going to say a movie. I'm actually going to say a TV show. And I hate to say it, trashy reality television, Love is Blind. We watched it at the very, very beginning of the pandemic, right when it literally everything was shut down. You couldn't even like step out of your house without thinking that you were going to get COVID in like March. And it was a really light show. It was actually really fun in order to see how it all worked out. Obviously, it's contrived and ridiculous, and there was full of drama, but the inner trashy reality loving teenager that lives within me definitely came out, and it was fun to indulge that at least for a short period of time. What was yours, Marshall?
My answer is a bit silly, but my favorite movie during the quarantine lockdown was Trolls 2. If you all remember, that came out direct to digital instead of going into theaters. I didn't see Trolls 1 before, so I was a little skeptical when Sagar and his girlfriend encouraged us to watch it. But honestly, it was a really fun movie. Yeah. The singing, the dancing, everything. And when we were just feeling really down, not knowing what was going to happen next, it was a really great escapist movie. I'm definitely not going to watch it again until I have kids, but it was a great time there.
Big fan of Trolls. Can't wait for Trolls K-pop crossover, which I know is coming. All right, guys, as always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring the work on this podcast. And with that, let's dive into this amazing conversation, and we will see you all on Thursday.
Matt, Swati, welcome to The Realignment.
Happy to be here.
Indeed.
Good to see you.
So usually we open up an episode by introducing the guest, discussing the context, but in this case especially, I want to start with the frame of our show. It's called The Realignment. We're interested in the fact that the country's changing in a million different ways. We started with politics and policy, but obviously to your space, Matt, and to yours as well, Swati, there's tech. So there's all these different things going on. We're in a world where Jack Dorsey is tweeting about decentralizing himself away. Matt, your claim to fame is definitely joining the first team working on the iPhone. It's not the same internet that they were working with then. So broadly speaking, I would just want both of your thoughts. What are you thinking in this moment? Because the positions you're in are just at the center of all the different trends of this moment. So I would just like to get in where your headspace is at right now.
Yeah, I think we're at the turning point like of another industrial revolution, so to speak. You think about like the generational changes that have happened over the last several hundred years, and things are really moving faster. We're like, we have the advent of the internet in our own generation, but I think we're at the point now where it's time for another realignment. That's a good way of putting it. And our policy and our regulations have not caught up with our technology. And technology moves way, way faster than any of those things do. So yeah, I think it's we're at this time where, we're creating new things faster than we're able to understand them, which is a really tough place to be from a policy perspective.
I think a lot of these days about values and people. So, 15 years ago when Matt and I were starting our career, the focus was so much on technology, like it was this inevitable force of just these wonderful, delightful experiences that you could build. But increasingly, as those have gone from being Davids to Goliaths in our current world environment, it's really clear that it becomes equally important to meet technology with good people who are motivated by the right values, who are super forthright about what those values are. And, the things that we build are informed by that understanding. And I think we've maybe over-indexed on the technology stuff and under-indexed on the people behind those technologies, the people for whom technologies work, and what values these things that we're creating are really meant to amplify or diminish.
So So this is so fascinating to me because it seems to me that the central side of this debate, and both of you can correct me if I'm wrong because you guys are actually involved in it, is it seems on the one hand you got Jack Dorsey, who's like, I actually have too much power and no person at all should have this much power. As in, no matter what my values are, no matter what, it seems to me that the technology itself is so powerful that decentralizing and making so that nobody has the power over it is the likely way to go. Some of our other guests we've had on our podcast are very much, you know, advocates of something in that direction. So by the way, not advocating for, but you're outlining as one of the solutions here is having people who are responsible within that. But ultimately, the failsafe is still the person. So how do you guys think about that in terms of the structure of tech going forward? Especially, I mean, it's not a secret, like a lot of the population doesn't trust tech, and I'm not sure if they should.
Yeah, and that's changed really quickly. Yeah. Like if you rewind the clock back even 3-4 years, that wasn't the case. People idolize a lot of those brands. I think it comes down to, yeah, like, the values that a lot of these companies are run by. And I don't know if I agree with the Jack Dorsey approach. Like, I don't know if a libertarian, like, let everyone fend for themselves approach is the right one. That's why we have government. The role of government is to look after the population and to provide structure for some of these things so that, one, companies can't run wild, but also there isn't total anarchy and chaos. Like, I don't know if anarchy and chaos is the right solution to this problem. I think rules are probably the right solution.
Okay, it's interesting. Even by, you know, when a founder comes out and says, I'm not sure if I should have all of the power that I have, to some extent, that's a version of his values that he's expressing. And at least there's more self-awareness in that statement than I think most founders that have commensurate amounts of power and influence these days articulate. And I actually think it goes back to my point that we should spend more time talking about why the Jack Dorseys of the world believe what they believe, whether or not we agree with what they believe, whether or not they should believe that or believe we think maybe something different than we do just, oh, Twitter's here, what's Twitter share price? We should care more about values than we do valuation.
So before we get into insight, the two of you just hit upon a big debate that helps frame how everyone should look at someone, which is how inevitable is anything? Because if you're a decentralizing libertarian, you say things like, well, we're all sovereign individuals now. This is referencing our guests from our last episode. We're all sovereign individuals, and we're ultimately the customers of government, and we're not tied to this thing. So if we get your tax too high, we'll move to Miami or Austin, and then maybe Singapore after that. So at a certain point, regulation isn't the answer because we could actually move beyond that. And technology makes it so that those pre-fourth industrial revolution era debates don't really matter at all. So how, when you think about the combination of tech and politics, how do you think about that inevitability debate as we're thinking about that?
Yeah. I mean, reflecting on what you just said, it's actually a position of great privilege. And I think, and this is, again, is also part of the problem, is you have a lot of very, very wealthy Stanford graduate white men who are in these positions of very, you know, very high power and influence. And they have the ability to move to Miami or move to Singapore, but the rest of the population doesn't have that capability or that flexibility. So again, it reflects on the situation and kind of, you know, like their own biases that they might even be aware of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, is it inevitability? Like, look, it is inevitable that we need to regulate technology, just like every other industry in the country. And, you know, it is inevitable. We have to do it. And I think, if anything, tech has gotten by for a very long time, primarily because of speed, has gotten by without regulation, or at least any major regulation.
But also relevance. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, it wasn't the dominant
sector of the economy,
and it didn't inform so many aspects of everyday life for so many people. So in some ways, it's the ultimate compliment. You know, the success of our theory of change is that we've gotten so big and so influential that it's now a conversation. We're in the public domain. Like, everybody has a stake in this industry's performance, and the industry has to kind of come to terms with that.
And the reality is every other major industry in the country has a three-letter acronym regulating body, right? Like, what is the SEC for tech? It doesn't exist today. We have all these agencies and government to protect the population and to provide a check on industry. And those things can work hand in hand. It's not like regulation stops growth and stops innovation and stops progress. But it's important to have that check. And today that check does not exist.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me because I'm hearing, you know, you've been very successful. And so, by the way, coming to you from Nest Wi-Fi, so thank you, Matt. And I'm like fascinated because, you know, Marshall and I were in Silicon Valley, I guess about a year or so ago. We're sitting at this table, there's a bunch of successful founders, you know, whatever, a bunch of paper billionaires. And what they were all telling us is they were like, you know, if we were, when we were founding a company in 2017, we didn't even think about the government. They're like, but now you basically have to think about the government. And this is a 2 to 3 year like sea change that has happened dramatically. And of course, you know, all tech now is politics. All politics now is tech. We talked about that in our last episode. And so what's fascinating to me is that now the question is about who the regulator gets to be. That's a civic area of politics, but also kind of where you guys come in and your organization. So as Marshall said, you know, usually, and we'll do a short readout whenever we do an official intro. Just tell us about what you guys are working on. Because it's not, it's like venture capital. It's also like political advocacy. It's like, but everything rolled into one.
It's, yeah, really it's a mix of, but, all those things. So better than us, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really simply, we think that there should be more good people building things that are worth building in technology. And so we have put our capital and our time and our talents to work to provide a supportive platform for more entrepreneurs that we think embody our values and values that are maybe underrepresented in the ecosystem these days. So we are set up in such a way that we can fund these really great founders, whether they are building companies, mission-oriented companies, nonprofits, and increasingly if they are folks that are getting into the civic arena and doing political work.
Yeah, like it turns out there's a pretty big funding gap, especially at the early stages. Like in Silicon Valley, there's a whole like robust ecosystem of like angel investors and seed funds to help founders start companies. But that funding gap, the funding doesn't exist in other arenas. And, you know, we took our kind of lessons from technology and venture and are applying it to other areas too.
We call it insight because part of what we're doing is trying to create meaningful catalytic change in specific industries, in the tech sector, in some of the specific social and philanthropic areas that we care about, like climate change. And a lot of it is also motivated by the experiences that like Matt had firsthand when he was in the thick of it building his last company, Nest.
So the question that immediately comes to mind, because we have a decently bipartisan audience and you all have said things and we'll say things that will tick off half the audience, other probably tick off the other half. But right now, any Bernie Sanders voting listener is screaming at us for not asking you all about money in politics. And I want to go a bit deeper than the obvious excuse, because I genuinely mean this. I do not think the two of you are paying people under the table to do climate change or like whatever you're thinking about. I think that surface level conversation about political corruption is often not useful because to a certain degree, it's a straw man. Like I don't think it's true that oil billionaires give money and then like some Republican politician says, I don't believe in climate change. It's actually like a much more complicated thing where there's an intersection of the culture wars and deep seated beliefs, et cetera. But here's the question for the two of you. What are your views around the effect that your money and the process that you participate has on politics? To what degree do you think when you give money to someone, you're expecting them to do different things? How do you just think about that framework? Because this is the part that people just probably don't have any understanding of.
Yeah, I think at the principle, I find the process of donating, it's a part of like, let's call it like your speech, but the reality is like, why should our speech be worth more than other people's speech? I think that's the fundamental problem with the system. And I don't like the laws that we have. And you know, if we don't exercise our speech, then we just don't, like we end up not having a seat at this table at all. And you know, like the much louder, much larger donors on the, let's call it like the far right side may not have, you know, they may drown us out, so to speak. Like we have the tools that the law gives us. I'd rather not use the tools at all, but if we don't exercise the tools, then you know, it's not a fair playing field anymore. But like, the reality is like, there should be no money in politics. You know, let's have this thing, we all be publicly funded. But you know, like if all of one party's donors decide to sit out on principle, it's gonna be a pretty nasty election.
Hmm. Look, I can tell you firsthand, the amount of influence that money has in our political process and systems is undue, and it is worrisome. It's a problem. I believe that to my core. But not just, Marshall, for some of the obvious reasons that you alluded to, it's also a problem because of the ways in which we know conscious and unconscious bias plays into money and politics and who it keeps out of the political process as much as who it keeps in. Part of the reason why I started Arena and why I've gotten so much more involved in organizing financial resources for candidates and causes is because we know in the data that, for example, women and people of color disproportionately face way more hardship raising money, that newcomers to the political process, new generation leaders, have a much harder time raising financial resources to be in the civic arena doing work on the public's behalf. And in this case, my participation can help right what are already some incredibly skewed scales. So look, I want to get money out of politics and the influence out, and that's a lifelong aspiration. But I'm also a realist enough to understand that I've got to get in there and play by the existing rules in order for us to be in a position to change these rules. Hmm.
So I'll put this in startup terms that you all will recognize. The Clayton Christensen idea, innovator's dilemma, it's very hard for an incumbent legacy thing to disrupt itself. At what point do you think that applies to the idea of giving? Because I can entirely, so think about it this way, right? I could think, and by the way, I totally believe that the two of you want to remove money from politics. But once you get to the seat of the table, it's very easy to say, okay, we can have all this money, but Joe Biden only has 100 days to make a big impact. Campaign finance reform could be one of those impact areas. But, you know, as you've alluded to, there's also the possibility of court packing. Well, there's also student loan forgiveness. There's also Medicare for all. So it's very easy to see, and this is almost certainly what's going to happen, campaign finance reform get moved down the ladder. So how, as you're engaging with this process, do you work around that fact that almost certainly there are going to be incentives that push anyone who engages the system to return back more and more to the norm?
It's a really thoughtful question. Unfortunately, we have a mostly incumbent leadership in DC, or will have a mostly incumbent leadership in DC. And yeah, we had a very robust primary cycle, but we ended up with a very traditional kind of leadership. I don't expect campaign finance reform to be a priority for this administration.
I will also say that I think we think about this like a marathon as well as the individual track races of specific campaign cycles. And one of the big learnings for us, I mean, we were folks that were not very politically active prior to 2016. Yeah. So we kind of had a crash course the last 4 years. And one of the biggest lessons that we've learned is that it's so important to invest not just in specific candidates and races for specific positions, but really in the infrastructure and ecosystem that is supportive of deep democracy reform and a more level playing field and better access to voting and the franchise. So we, as part of like our giving, for example, in addition to supporting breakout candidates, we also invest in great organizations like the Arena, like the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, like vote.org, groups that are there doing the work, not just in election years with an eye towards winning specific races, but in kind of making long-term organizing investments to promote these democracy reform issues.
Hmm. See, what's interesting though, and is we've got a sizable right-wing audience too. And like they'll hear that and they're going to hear, here are these two high net worth Silicon Valley individuals who, you know, that a lot of what you're code for is saying like expanding, you know, votes or whatever in states they're going to flip in order to help Joe Biden or whomever Democrat win the election. So when you're trying to approach this and your politics and where you guys are, you know, currently situated in the industry, which is now getting fire from both sides, how do you guys think about your roles? I'm not even talking necessarily about money, but really in terms of actually like trying to find some sort of harmonious solutions for the overall country.
I mean, to me, it goes back to core values. I mean, I think I'm comfortable knowing that there might be certain things that I value that other people don't. So for example, You might not believe that in America in 2021, every legal citizen over the age of 18 should have the right to vote. Mm-hmm. You might not value that in the same way that I do, but mm-hmm. I'm willing to have a conversation with you about that. And I'm also cool for us to agree to disagree on that. You might not agree that a young brown woman should have an opinion about who runs for office and whether or not the composition of our elected officials should reflect the demographics of our general population. You might not agree with me on that, but I value it and I'm willing to put in the work and where I can to organize the financial resources. Because the other thing is, it's not just the contribution that Matt and I make, it's also that we go out there and we talk to other people in our community about why we value this and we encourage them to get in and support these efforts too. You might not value these things in the way that I do, but then get out there and do the work.
So here's a question. Looking through the background of the two of you, especially the work on the political side, in a past America, let's remove various issues of like racism, anti-Semitism, et cetera. In the 1950s and 1960s, Swati, you especially, you would probably be running to be, so let's remove gender too. You'd be running to be the head of the Democratic National Committee, because that was the position where, frankly, money was doled out, where these things were coordinated. And as I'm thinking about the system that's getting propagated here, a concern that I have is, once again, forgetting the money for a second, the lack of democratic small d responsiveness to the giving and the organizing that you do. So for example, and we'll get into this in a bit, like Matt, something I really loved looking at your climate work is your idea of like, let's focus on big problems, let's attack big problems. That's the underlying thing that's undergirding y'all's work. But at a certain point, it's the two of you deciding what those big problems are. Mm-hmm. And something that we're seeing as big institutions like the DNC and the RNC, this isn't a left-right issue, lose actual legitimacy amongst younger people or just anyone in general is you don't have the platform matter. So as I was thinking about the way we used to determine, especially as Democrats on your side, what matters is there be a platform committee and that'd be raucous and it'd be terrible. And you'd have the 1968 convention, there'd be rioting and death and it'd be horrible, but there would be something that's responsive and democratic. So when you two sit down and say, these are the candidates we want to support, as you say, these are the issues we prioritize, how do you think about that? Because the last thing I want to add to this monologue is I'm thinking of an audience member right now who says, okay, so Matt and Swati think that climate change is the big problem. Right now, I actually think that as a conservative, I personally am not comfortable online. And I think that's a huge problem. So like, how do I get my voice heard with them? So how do you just think about the nature of institutions, democratic responsiveness, and the role you're playing there?
Yeah, I mean, there's, I'd say, a lot of responsibility that we faces our decisions. And yes, we are bringing our own values to the table when we make decisions. And like when we make an investment decision or the decision to support someone, like we're bringing our values into that decision. Not everyone in the country shares our values. Yeah, this is one of the problems with having money in politics. But it's not even a money in politics discussion too. It's also about investment. And when we select a founder to receive an investment, we're also making a values judgment on that founder too. It's like, is this founder someone we want to run a company and be successful one day? And we don't often share with the libertarian, let's call it like whatever happens, happens point of view. Like we may not back a libertarian anarchist founder. Mm-hmm. And that's us applying a values decision values judgment on our investment decision.
It's an interesting question that you're asking, Marshall. And just to kind of pick up on some of the threads that Matt's put out there. I mean, the other thing that I think is really interesting is we live in this moment where in part because of the advent of technology, we've been able to democratize small d political participation really to an extent that in our lifetime, Matt and I have never seen. And you can see it on the financial side in politics, but also just in the sheer numbers of people that are participating, having an opinion. I think, in the primaries in 2019, there were a record number of like 8 million Americans that made small dollar contributions to a presidential primary process. because you can get online and learn about candidates and express your opinion by engaging with them digitally, by making small dollar contributions. And so I also think for the listener that's out there and maybe thinks, you know, I'm not in a position to write huge checks or throw money around in politics. The good news is there has been no better moment than the current moment for you to just take what energy and time you have and figure out how to give it expression and how to be an active and involved part of our civic life and our political process. So the most important thing is that if you've got a strong point of view or you believe in something, that you take an, that you express it and that you take meaningful, lawful action. I think sometimes increasingly in this moment, we have to make that distinction about what is acceptable and unacceptable action. But engagement itself is a really good thing.
Yeah, I know. I think that's interesting too. It's you know, the obvious thing that I think somebody more skeptical or like who's had a problem with this before would be like, well, I tried and then, you know, they shut down my website, or like, or I tried to get my company funded, but the ideological capture of the select group of people who dole out money in Silicon Valley simply would not, you know, fund my idea. And this isn't just a right wing thing. I think probably a left wing thing too. One of the criticisms and that I hear from a lot of, you know, some of the more Bernie aligned fans and listeners that we have is like, I can't get something that I want off the ground. So like, for example, Swathi, like when you were talking about funding different types of candidates who are diverse, they'd be like, yeah, I think diversity is great. But like the question is, it's like you have two black women and one wants a wealth tax and Medicare for all. And the other one is talking about just like advancing progressivism. Like, I'm pretty sure I know who's going to get the more money from ultra high net worth individuals. So like, how do you think about economics? I know some of you guys thought about like the populist moment and more, but just generally, you know, respond to that critique of when concentrated capital has an ideological framework about the way that that is going to push our politics, especially left politics, if you're a Democrat and you're thinking about economic class issues, that's something you should care about, and also from the right as well.
You know, I also think that you've got to pay attention to the outliers from that trend. To Sagar, you know, we also know it's a truism in 2021 that you can be the candidate that raises the most money and still lose elections. Yeah. Yeah, so let's also be real. It's not like money is the only predictor of success. And in fact, to the analogy that you just gave, I mean, I think about an amazing candidate like Marquita Bradshaw in Tennessee, who, having raised less than $50,000, goes on to win the Democratic primary for Senate in the state of Tennessee. That's
huge.
Amazing. Right. That just happened a couple of months ago. So there is also something about being the right candidate with the right message for what the people will. And I think we've still got to acknowledge when our system allows for those really pure things to prevail. And again, persistence pays. I mean, I also think oftentimes first-time candidates will run for office two or three times before they're successful. Because if they don't get there the first time, they roll up their sleeves and get back out there and do it again. And we see the same thing in great entrepreneurs. Persistence is one of these undervalued and underspoken about attributes that doesn't oftentimes make it into the more popularized myth of the founder, right? We love to think about the person that just had a light bulb and went out there and made the thing happen. But you don't often hear the backstory, the fact that like that person might have been on their second or third attempt at getting a business off the ground by the time they had their really big success.
When you're looking at the issues that could change over the next 6 months to the next year, to even the next 100 days, how do you prioritize that list of things? So there's everything from healthcare reform, we have to fix our supply chains. There's almost this like massive list of things we have to prioritize. Let's just get your general thoughts on what's basically your top three, or even how are you just thinking about even how you judge what we should prioritize and focus on?
Yeah. I feel like we're at one of those turning points as a country, probably as a planet, and maybe my own personal beliefs and biases are playing in here. We had one of the worst global pandemics in a century. We also have, you know, massive income inequality. We've got like a economic crisis, and we've got a climate crisis. And I think this is, again, like we're at one of those turning points where we could choose to face those things head on and attack these problems together, or we cannot. And I'm actually really hopeful that the next 100 days, year, even maybe 2 years, like we can make a considerable dent in income inequality, racial inequality, climate, and health together. Like we could actually like build a package to work on these things together. And I think we get the political will to do it. I'm hopeful. Mm-hmm. I look back like coming out of the 2007-2008 crisis. Yeah, we got out of the crisis, but we didn't really move the ball forward. And my hope is that the second time around, Biden and the Biden administration have learned the lessons of that. Now, I guess you could get out of the crisis, but really don't move forward any progress.
Yes. Well, I want to ask you this specifically to build on something Matt said, his reference to the word together, which you could have been referring to as Democrats, but there's also the bipartisan application of that. And we were listening back to your episode of our friend Alex Kantrowitz, which was a great episode, by the way. It was really helpful to listen to. But you made a comment about how you were excited that there were these debates on the right, specifically with like Marco Rubio and Josh Hawley, about the free market. And those are debates that we've been very involved in. We've covered them. It's an important issue. But something that I've found is that when left of center people look at those debates, they just focus on, hey, it's really cool, but some Republicans don't want to just focus on tax cuts. But they then forget that, but guess what? Those Republicans are also socially conservative, as you would expect Republicans to be. They also, like to Josh Hawley's example last week, hold views and are going to make decisions that you disagree with. You know, we saw that you tweeted that you were in favor of Simon and Schuster removing his book contract for June. And separate from commenting on that, I just want to think, like, how do you think about how frustrating this moment is for that broader topic? Because what I definitely don't think there's going to happen, you're definitely not going to see this left-right economic post-neoliberal moment because of these social dynamics. That's something a lot of our audience gets excited about. They see Bernie Sanders and Josh Hawley speaking. They're like, this is the future. They're going to overturn the RNC and the DNC. And that just clearly isn't going to happen. So how is you, as someone who followed that debate and that trend, how are you thinking about the togetherness idea?
So to me, it goes back to what we started our conversation with. It's really about being anchored in values and what we value at this moment. I mean, I think more than anything, the national conversations that are being had across the country, in houses, among business owners, in DC, among the folks that are thinking about transitioning in a new government, are really one around what the new normative environment in this country ought to look like. What do we value and why? And that transcends political party. I mean, part of what was interesting about that particular conversation I was having with Alex is, I think we are very acutely, and have been for a time, but we are very acutely in this moment where we should be questioning some of the fundamental things that we've accepted as fundamental givens about capitalism that is completely unfettered and who it works for and why. And it's great that those are questions that are getting asked on both sides of the aisle, because at its core, there's a values question. Is it about markets at any cost, or are markets tools that work for people? And the more that we anchor in those values, like these fundamental questions of what we value as a country for individual people, I think the better able we are to talk across partisan divisions, across generational divisions, to kind of figure out where we want to go next. And to your point, Marshall, maybe that's not some grand new theory that replaces liberalism or neoliberalism. I think we just need to understand what the next couple of steps are going to be. Or, you know, the phrase that my friend Pete likes to use is, what do we think about what will define this next American era?
And by your friend Pete, you mean, I guess, secretary Buttigieg? Presumptive?
Or secretary designate, I think. Yeah. Yes.
It does not roll off the tongue the same way Mayor Pete does.
No, but I think it's like a really powerful message that he delivered, as a candidate in the primary and also on behalf of the Biden campaign, the idea that whether you vote as a Republican or a Democrat, we can all agree that we have a shared interest in where this country goes in the future, and that there's a real opportunity to reset, or to use the language of the incoming Biden administration, there's an opportunity to build back better.
So it's interesting, with regards to Pete, like, put it on the table. I'm going to say that the vast majority, but the most majority, are extraordinarily skeptical of Pete Buttigieg. And to hear somebody, you've known him for a long time, so you can expound on this, but to hear someone who's talking about recognizing the post-neoliberal moment, recognizing conscious capitalism, recognizing all of that, and then supporting someone like Pete would just seem irreconcilable in a lot of those minds. And I think what I'm particularly curious about is, look, the audience for this podcast, it's overwhelmingly young people. My other show, Rising, same thing, 25, you know, people who are below like 30 years old, essentially, have really just been screwed over by the system. And I'm just going to say, like, I did not see, you know, especially in the voter profile, the people who were coming out to vote for Buttigieg, I didn't really see that there. It was overwhelmingly much more with somebody like Bernie. And even I can even say on the Republican side, like amongst young Republicans, they are far more like Trumpy than they are anything in terms of Mitt Romney. Again, I think that the basis for that comes from the same kind of kernel of dissatisfaction with our current system. So I'm curious, just like on Buttigieg specifically, why he seemed like the candidate to transcend the neoliberal moment when it seemed almost as if he was just like uniting neoliberal economic policy with like a well-articulated progressive leftism whenever it came to social policy.
So many interesting things that you have put forward there. I mean, look, I think a couple of thoughts, and I'm just speaking from my personal experience as somebody who put an awful lot of sweat equity into helping that candidate and candidacy because I believed in the vision and the values. But, you know, a great example is this. Think about the how commonplace the notion, for example, of judicial reform and democracy reform has become in the current normative environment. And try and remember that 14 months ago, he was one of the only people out in the public realm championing mm-hmm. an idea that some people might have thought was like, they might have used words like radical or innovative or kind of atypical, uncommon to characterize. And I think you start to understand part of, I think, the appeal of getting more new entrants like Pete into the civic arena and why that informs so much of the work that I'm committed to and that Matt and I do. It's because sometimes just a fresh voice and a different perspective is what it takes to transcend all of these frameworks, red versus blue, different mm-hmm. notions of isms, to just simple common sense. Like, we agree we want something better. Why can't it be this much? Why can't it look like this?
Hmm. Well, I mean, on this court, you know, by the way, funny story. It was Pete who inspired me back when I was a White House correspondent to actually ask Trump about Supreme Court packing. So you are correct. You did influence the political debate in that way. But if we were going to think about court packing as the example in which he pushed the, you know, the envelope, that doesn't really have anything to do with, I mean, again, that's to most people, I think, pretty transparently a vehicle for progressivism whenever it comes to, at least socially, whenever it comes to.
Now it is. Now it is.
Well, but see, that's my thing, is now it's sticking again in the progressive social values. We haven't talked, that's not really anything about healthcare. It's not anything about economics, about the class system that we currently have in America. And so it just seems like, to the extent that he was successful in pushing the envelope in any way, it was mainstreaming an idea for largely a vehicle of social progressive change, not necessarily anything to do with the reason that somebody is supporting a Bernie Sanders or the reason that somebody yeah. who's a union voter is going to vote for Trump.
I totally appreciate what you're saying. I also feel like we're getting a little bit sidetracked and turning this into mm-hmm. sort of like a single focus on Pete and his record.
Sure, but, right.
You know, we could also go back and relive every moment of that primary, but I think I'm a lot more interested in focusing on the future. I mean, I will also say there were so many other examples in that experience during that primary where this candidate and his campaign were so great at putting forward bold ideas on the economic side too. I mean, I think a lot about his proposal, for example, for communities of color and his policy proposals focused on Black America, which had really, really important, significant economic and class related propositions alongside the social ones. And he was really the first candidate in the field to put those kinds of ideas out there, his Douglas plan. So there were examples of that too. I don't think this was an attribute that was only for social issues. And my bigger point still is, it's more than any one of these individual ideas. It's the idea that when we got somebody who was new and talented to the table, they were able to articulate ideas and paint a vision for a better future that defied some of the frameworks that can be very limiting that tend to dominate our political conversation in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So in our last bit, let's pivot to the future. So we're moving into 2021. Matt, you've written a lot about and have spoken a lot about the issue of climate change. And climate change is this interesting area where it's a combination of governmental action, but there's also private action, especially in the venture and the tech space. So two things. Actually, I want to know, have you all read Anand Giridhar's book, Winners Take All?
I haven't read it in full. Don't tell Anand that, but we've read parts of it for sure.
Yeah. So something I'm just interested, I read it just to honestly prep for this show, and something that I want to get your thoughts on, Max, you spoke about this in a different podcast appearance, is, as I understand his thesis, it's basically the idea that the problem in our current system is that we outsource public problems to the private sector. So we say things like, "Quick, let's all be winners. Let's make some money. Let's invest in the long term. And then we're going to do climate tech," instead of saying, "Hey, let's rejoin the, not the Kyoto, there's too many protocols. Let's rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, or let's pass the Green New Deal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." The take I have, though, to what I think his framework misses, is that major climate change legislation is just not on the table right now. So it's not as if you have the ability to say, okay, we have the Green New Deal, or we can invest in my climate fund. Let's choose the one that helps my net worth. That's not what's on the table. So to a certain degree, the private sector has to respond. But how do you all just think about that framework within the climate space?
Yeah. We've been on this road since the 1950s, where government has been handing off public responsibility to private companies. This is not a new thing. This has been over several generations now. But the point is right. Like we've effectively outsourced a lot of public good to companies. And in this moment, in the next nine moments, this is going to be a decades long moment, a lot of industry will need to change. The entire economy will need to change. And this is not like a Green New Deal versus private investment even conversation, because it touches everything. Like there are very few moments where our food supply, our energy supply, transportation, how we manage land, agriculture, the oceans, how we deal with trash. Like it's like literally everything that we build stuff, like everything must change. And that is not something on the scale of any one company or any one industry. It is literally everything. And it requires government action, because like that many industries will not change on their own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we will get some substantial climate action done.
What do you think?
Knowing a lot of the players that Biden has selected for his administration and for his cabinet, they are highly motivated. I think especially Jennifer Granholm is an example.
Mm-hmm.
Having her picked to lead the Energy Department is brilliant. Like, she understands jobs and job creation. She, from Michigan, a lot of auto industry and post economic recovery work. And we've got to get people back to work post COVID. And we've got the climate crisis right on our heels. It's not hard to tie these things together. And that hence why I'm quite optimistic. Like, Biden is picking people who understand that concept and are highly, highly motivated to drive some significant changes.
It sounds like there's an opportunity here to do right by the environment, but in a way that also does right by more Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to my point earlier about like post 2008 recovery, we bail out the economy, but like we didn't really get people back to work, and we didn't improve wages.
3 or 4 years. It took mm-hmm. a long time.
Yeah, like, we have that opportunity now. Let's do it right, and let's bring more people in. And that's bipartisan. That's across the country. Like, this problem is big enough that it will affect everybody.
Yeah. So as we're nearing the end here, I don't want to dredge up the past too much, but everything you're saying about 2009, the financial crisis, climate change, it just makes me think we're weirdly just resetting to 2009, in the sense that you have a Democratic Senate, you have a Democratic Congress, there's a Democratic president, some of the same literal people are there. back then, the choice was very concertedly made not to choose, for example, climate change, healthcare and economic recovery over an issue like prioritizing with climate change. So as you think back to the 2009 period, obviously you weren't politically active back then. As you're thinking and as the friends you have in the Biden administration think, what have you all learned from that experience right before the rise in the Tea Party that you think is going to influence the way the next 6 months is going to go?
To me, one of the lessons is, and I was definitely guilty of this. I mean, I took 2 weeks off of my job in 2008 to go door to door in Florida and help turn out voters. And then after the inauguration day, I kind of just peaced out. I was like, okay, cool. In 4 years, I'll come back and vote.
We did it.
Yeah. Okay. Passing the baton to you. And to me, the biggest lesson from the last 4 years is I've gotten more involved for the 4 years to come is that now is not the time to step off the gas. It's not like, you know, our job as citizens is to vote people in and then they get to do the work. The way that this democracy thing works is we got to keep paying attention. And if there are things that we want that we think should be priorities, you know, there's a new administration coming in to do the work, but it's also on us outside of government to keep voicing our values and to set expectations on where we think our country should head. And that, you know, can either buy an administration air cover to get things done, or it gives them a foil to push back on in the event that they disagree. But that's how the system works. And that's one of the lessons for me is like, you gotta keep getting out there and supporting great candidates, investing in great civic organizations, bringing up entrepreneurs who are building things that we think are worth building.
And keep the pressure on the administration to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Matt, that's on all of us.
Yeah. Matt, here's kind of my final question for you. You were in the room on the iPhone. You created Nest. I think the iPhone is probably the last like truly world-changing technology, as in it's the last thing that really changed the way that we interact every single day at every single moment. Mm-hmm. What do you think the next one is going to be? Just with your familiarity, with the experience and more, and how is that going to create all of the social problems that the iPhone created for us?
Oh man.
That's your $1 trillion fund. Yeah, if you get both of those together.
maybe this is bringing my own biases to the table, but I don't think it's going to be any one device that's going to do this, but the freeing us from a carbon emitting economy will be that next transition. I'm talking about like the next industrial revolution. That is what I mean. We've been in an extractive economy the last 150 years, like basically through the industrial revolution. And I think the transition we're going to make over the next 20 years is to be regenerative economy, to be more circular economy. And again, that's not any one device, but that is a multi-trillion-dollar transition. Hmm.
So last question, Swathi, we're looking for a thing we could clip for the next 10 years. You met Pete Buttigieg in college. You gave him $20 during his first campaign. You are a talent scout. Who is the person who in 2032, we can look back and say their name was mentioned on this podcast? Like who are some people who you're really excited about that you get that feeling? Because this is also your job as a VC too, right? Like there are different types of founders. Like who's like a state legislator we've never heard of who really impressed you?
So not a state legislator, but a county judge, Lena Hidalgo, in Harris County. If you haven't heard her name or you're not paying attention,
meet her.
Check her out. Meet
Texas.
Her. Texas. Texas. Yeah. Harris County.
Houston.
Yeah. Yeah. She is not yet 30 years old. The only Latina sort of judge in all of Texas. Might actually be the youngest local level administrator for a jurisdiction at that size in America, actually. Anyway, she's phenomenal, literally has helped keep millions of people alive and healthy when she kind of managed COVID better than the governor in the state was willing to do when it broke out last spring. So one to watch for sure. And then on the company side, we have a really talented founder in our portfolio named Zuleika Strassner, who's building a sustainable grocery delivery company called Zero. And Matt and I both agree that she is one of the most talented entrepreneurs that we've ever worked with. Most people haven't heard of her or they're not yet using Zero.
They will.
We're all going to know her. We may one day work for her.
I keep saying, last question, how was the name Zero not taken? That seems like the most obvious. You know, that's like my first question.
Zero.com?
Now you're starting to see some of Blake's genius.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, you heard it here first, folks. A company, a candidate, a judge. Thank you so much for coming. Really appreciate it.
Thank you guys.
Thank you guys for keeping us on our toes.
Yeah.
It's our job.
Hope you all enjoyed the episode. As we mentioned, we will see you on Thursday on the other end of Joe Biden's inauguration. We're going to have a great episode for you. We had so many questions that came in after last week, so we were doing an extended Q&A along with our interview with Michael Lind, who, as you all have heard us mention, his book, The New Class War, is one of the best books for understanding the moment that we are living in right now. The number one piece of feedback we got from our episode of Eric last week is just the fact that everyone is trying to figure out how to think about the country, the world, how we should be feeling right now. And he is the perfect person to focus on that with. So be sure to tune in on Thursday. Last but not least, please be sure to rate the podcast 5 stars, subscribe to the newsletter, check out our bookshop, and share this with any of your family and friends or coworkers who are looking to get a little better understanding of how the country is working right now. And last but not least, huge thank you to Lincoln Network. We appreciate the work you all are doing to help us produce this show every single day.